So basically, what I'll try to do today is just to break the discussion on science and religion to its very basic building blocks, right to the bottom. So you'll see everything I do will be mostly split in three columns, so you can compare just three things. And let's start with three then. Now, I don't know if you recognize any of them. Two are actors, but one in the middle is the real McCoy. That's Stephen Hawking in the middle, supposed to be Albert Einstein and Isaac Newton. So some people consider these three to be the like the holy trinity of the science, the three greatest scientists who ever lived. Some people believe them. So what we will do today, we'll look at their mindset and perspectives and how it connects and parallels with religion and bring religion and science together and try to establish that these two are not so different as they may be presented to us. So let's just start with the oldest of them all, Isaac Newton. So he is the one who would represent really the theistic science, somebody who believes in God, scientist who believes in God. Obviously, lived in the 17th century, it was just a common belief, everybody believed in God in those days. But, you know, he was a very clever chap, wasn't he, Isaac Newton? Mm-hmm. He invented a new type of mathematics. Nobody would question his mathematical skills, would they? Even today, all the rockets sent into space, that's calculated still through his calculations. So, his maths are flawless. But it so happens that he studied the biblical prophecies also, and especially in the books of Daniel and Revelation. And he actually predicted that the end of the world would come in 2060. So unlike most other people who predicted Christ is coming today, in my own day, he sort of said about 400 years from now, since when he lived anyway. And well, if prophecy is anything to do with mathematics, you better watch it, because who can question his math skills? But maybe it's more about spiritual things, so believe that. So he was a scientist who believed in God, he believed in the Bible. We move further into the future, into the 19th and then 20th century, and then Albert Einstein, who was a scientist, who was, well, what was he? Was he religious? Yes, no, maybe, maybe not. That's what he would say. So he was a representative of agnostic science. It means agnostic, I don't know. I don't know whether there is God or there is God. I can't say that he is there, I can't say he's not there. So that's what he would say. So some of his quotes actually reveal that. And he would say that science without religion is lame, and religion without science is blind. So he doesn't put down religion, does he? Unlike some other people, some other scientists. And then some of the things that he struggled with and tried to figure out how this universe works, he said, another thing he said, I have deep faith that the principle of the universe will be beautiful and simple once you break it all down. Obviously, why did he say I have deep faith? Because there's no evidence, he couldn't figure it out. So he relied on faith and he didn't put religion down. So this is a scientist who is not necessarily a believer, but he's not an unbeliever also. He's sort of open-minded, he's not sure, he doesn't know. And then we move further towards the end of the 20th century, 21st century, and then we have an atheistic science. Now we have scientists who don't believe in God. Stephen Hawking, bless him, you can never imagine his sufferings, can you? Never imagine that. But, you know, a famous book he wrote, A Brief History of Time, he describes, you know, the whole, in the short book, beautifully describes the whole sort of scientific story of how the world came to be and everything. And amazingly, he did say, after explaining all the, you know, Big Bang and everything else, he says, now we're discussing history of time. What happens before time, we don't know. So whether there is a divine creator or not, we don't know that. Now that was the first edition of his book. In the second edition of his book, he deleted that. And he says it's got no need for God or any kind of hypothesis like that. So something happened to him between the first and the second edition that he is clearly an atheist towards the end. And perhaps his sufferings have to do something with it. I don't know. I suspect that, but it's not for us to judge. So, three different scientists relating to religion in three different ways. Believers, those who are neither here nor there, agnostics, and then atheists, non-believers. And some years ago, when Nastasya was still in primary school, they had a class, they had group discussions around the tables, and they discussed the origin, so everybody around the table was to share how they believe this world came to be. So they talked about things, and Nastasya said, you know, God created the world in 6 days, 7 days, and then somebody laughed. That's really stupid, isn't it? I can believe that nowadays. So she was really shaken about it and upset. We had to talk through these things for months. Had to do studies, discuss things, and then the first thing I told her, look, you can believe whatever you want, you don't have to believe the same I do. Let's have a look at it. Let's have a look at both sides and compare and see pros and cons and put it on the paper and then you decide what you want to believe. You know, it's up to you. Don't feel pressured by kids in the class or me or anybody. You decide what you want to believe. So we talked about it a lot. And one of the first things that we had to deal with, this really is the first question you have to deal with, is the beginning. It's the beginning. So Brian Cox, for instance, he used to be young, not so much anymore. He's a hip guy, he plays in a pop band or synth band, and he's a physicist, so he's the face of BBC's evolution storyline nowadays, still. So, you know, he made a statement and most of them agree with this. In the beginning, there was nothing. Okay? And looking at the Bible, for instance, obviously this was quoted from the Bible and then changed a little bit, intentionally, clearly. The Bible claims that in the beginning was God. So, basically, this is the underlying principle. Most of the scientists today say that something came from nothing. The Bible claims that something came from something. This was really the foundation stone upon which we built when I spoke to Nastasya. We have to start here. So you tell me, what do you think? What do you think? You know, just use your brains. Don't listen to anybody else. You've got a brain like anybody else has a brain. Which one is more attractive to you or more sensible to you? Something came from nothing or something came from something? So that's where our discussion started. And all many other things we discussed were built upon this. And so you ask yourself the same question. This is the starting question, really. And I'm sure you have asked yourself something similar already, but this is really the key principle. What do you believe? Have you seen any evidence for something coming from nothing in your life experience?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm saying that it's right, but I'm just asking. Something came from something. Well, see what your life experience was. Right, so put everybody in three columns here. So you've got agnostic science on the one hand, people who says, I don't know, like Albert Einstein, if there is God or not. I'm not sure. I'm still looking. On the other extreme, on the other side is atheistic science. It says, I know definitely that there is no God. And then in the middle, theistic science, some people will say that, yeah, I know there is God, some people say, I believe there is God. And these three great scientists represent each one of these three columns. So the point is, all of their beliefs about God, really the bottom line is they're based on faith rather than evidence. Nobody can prove or disprove that there is God. God himself doesn't do it, so we try to do it, we'll probably fail on the way. So this is what atheistic science says: God doesn't exist. Theistic science says God exists and he's a person, he's the creator. And agnostic science says God, well, you know, Einstein, he was an agnostic. It sort of tends a little bit towards the Eastern religions, like Buddhism and Hinduism. So if there is God, he is really, is he in the universe? Maybe he is the universe. Maybe there is some kind of mind running, non-personal mind being. So it's a bit similar to the Eastern religions. And all these perspectives are based on belief rather than evidence. So this is no science. When scientists tell you anything about origins or God, to claim that this is a scientific fact or something like that, it's highly misleading. It's not. This is a religious statement. These are all religious statements because there is no evidence for any of them. So the question is, really, and you can put it in the three columns like this, because this column is very much like Eastern religion, so you can call it spirit religion. So it's all about immaterial things. Whereas atheistic science is all about material things. It's just matter, hard matter religion. And in the middle, you have the mixture of two. You have the spirit and the matter, and they sort of work together. But the quick question is, what is the ultimate nature of reality? What is it? Spirit? Is it matter? Is it both? And this question will ultimately answer the question, what is our eternal destiny and our future? Because this is the beginning. And each of the three perspectives that are in three different columns, one is spirit, we'll say, that's the ultimate reality. One will say it's matter, and one will say it's spirit and matter. Each of these three give a different perspective on origins, and then you can follow the logical story about what happens after the origins, life and death, and what happens after that, if anything, after you die. And who can say which one of us has been dead and came back to tell us? That's a difficult one to deal with, isn't it? So let's look at the three columns and compare them, starting with the question. So just to sum it up, one, if you remember Albert Einstein would be in this category, then Newton in the middle, and Stephen Hawking in the last column of materialism. So how do you view things in these columns? Right, so look at the beginning. The spirit, or spiritism you can call it, the spirit religion, they would say that spirit and mind is eternal. So that's what's eternal. There is no beginning to it, or some people say that your soul. It always existed, it always will exist, it's eternal. There is no beginning, there is no end. That's it. Your spirit, your soul, it's eternal. Yeah. It may take different forms or shapes throughout history, reincarnations, but it's eternal, it's not created, it cannot be destroyed. If you look at the end column, matter or materialism, now they say that matter was created at the beginning, and most scientists agree, all of them really, that this is the case. The universe was created at the beginning, so there is a beginning. Spirit or mind, that doesn't exist. They're just the brain, and brain is not spirit. Brain is made of matter, stuff. So everything is material. There's nothing spiritual in this universe. Spirit and mind doesn't exist on the brain. Now the middle column sort of brings the two together. Both spirit or mind and matter, both were created at the beginning. So there is spirit and there is matter, but they're not eternal. They're both created at the beginning. So what do you see? How do you compare the beginnings between the three? Any similarities there? You can see that those two columns agree actually on this. Spirit and matter and matter. They all say that there is a beginning. Whereas the spirit religions, they say there is no beginning. So that's the key difference. There's no beginning, and those two columns, they say there is beginning, but they disagree on the details. What happens after the beginning? Life. Life. So you can ask the question of the purpose of life. What is the purpose of life? If you look at spirit religions, again, all the Eastern religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, some other religions, because the spirit is the ultimate reality. Don't worry about the whole, you know, body and matter and all that stuff. The purpose of life is to escape from the prison of the body or matter, and to release the spirit into a non-material realm, non-personal realm, because you sort of, you drop out, your soul or spirit drops out into the ocean of eternal being, and everything is the same. There is no I there anymore, there is no person. But the purpose of life is to escape from matter and to become purely spirit, what apparently we always have been, because that's eternal. If you look at matter column, materialists, they basically just say there's no purpose to life, just get over it. You know, what's that all about? No purpose to life. Just get on with it and live your life and stop whining and complaining, yeah? That's what they say. In the middle, when you have spirit and matter intermingled, they're both part of the ultimate reality. The purpose of life is to relate to a personal God and to personal beings like you and me. And we are beings of flesh and blood, and we have mouths and ears and know that we can talk and we can think. And so both our spiritual and physical are important, and they coexist together. And it's very much of a relational reality and the purpose of life. So I have the beginning and then life. What comes after life? It comes death. Okay, we'll just go back a moment. Just have a look at the columns again and see where are the similarities and disagreements. In the first column, well, we have these two columns agree that there is a beginning, and that disagrees, there's no beginning. In the second column, the first two columns agree that there is a purpose of life. And that column disagrees, it says there is no purpose to life. And you find, move forward again, it's like swapping chess pieces, it keeps changing. So after life comes death. And in the spirit column, we find that physical death, when we die, what happens? It's the end of the person. So wherever you are, whatever your name is, whichever family you come from, or country, or whoever you are, that stops, ceases to exist. You may come back, I don't know, in your next life as something else, or a plant or an animal, but it's definitely not you anymore. Your knowledge, your memory, your feelings, your everything has disappeared. It's gone. So death is the end of the person. It's not the end of existence, but it's the end of the person, because the spirit or the soul, which is eternal, it fuses into this eternal universe, mind, being, impersonal experience. So it's impersonal. There's no person after you die. You're gone. Something remains, but it's not you. The person is gone forever. In the matter column, materialist, they also say that physical death is the end of the person. So you exist, you live this life, you die, that's it, you're gone forever. You know. When the brain dies, there's no other component to it. So it just disintegrates into molecules and atoms and goes back into the ground, and something grows out of it, a cow comes and eats it, and that's it. It's very materialistic. So you can see at the end here, the spirit and the matter, these columns agree, because it says once you're dead, that's the end of the person. The person doesn't exist anymore, it's gone forever. Even though they disagree in details. But the middle column, where spirit and matter are joined together, intermingled, say physical death is followed by judgment, because there's a personal God, and physical resurrection. You come back to life in a body. So it's physical. So this middle actually disagrees with both and says the person is still there. So you are raised back to life in a physical, material body. You're a spiritual being, you live in a material body, and it's you. It's you, it's your memories, it's your feelings, it's your personality, it's you, everything. You will continue to exist as a person. Whereas in the other two columns, whether you believe in the spirit, Eastern religions, or materialism, atheism, the person is gone, so you cease to exist forever. So I hope this helps you to see how these two compare along the journey from the beginning to the end. Now, the key thing to remember is that all that I've just shared with you, all these three perspectives, whether it's religious people or non-religious people, believers or non-believers, this is all based on faith rather than evidence. There was nobody there at the time of the very beginning to say, oh yeah, I've been there as an eyewitness, and this is how the universe was formed. I saw it with my own eyes. Well, that was the time before eyes existed anyway. Or to say there was a piece of equipment that was left there by accident, by somebody, and tested and measured all the events at the beginning, so we have the evidence. There is no evidence. There is no equipment. There is no eyewitness. Nothing like that. So when scientists speak of the origins, they're highly misleading in saying that this is how it happened. It's not. It's pure religion. It's pure faith. There's no evidence. And obviously the other columns, I mean, you have to take by faith what you believe, how this world came to be. And it's the same applies to after, what happens after we live and after we die. So there is no evidence regarding the origins, the beginnings. There are no eyewitnesses. Everything is, let's say, primordial, prehistoric. It's non-verifiable. Nobody can verify it or prove it or disprove it. That's it. So in this respect, whether you talk about science or religion, it comes to the same footing, equal opportunities. You know, one is no wiser than the other. We're all the same, exactly the same. Exactly the same. So, is there any other kind of evidence suggesting that any of these perspectives may be true? If you look at the origins, the beginning, there's no evidence. It has to be taken by faith. It's all about religions. Whether it's science or faith, it's religions. But is there any other kind of evidence suggesting that any of these perspectives may be true? Well, there is only one instance where there is some historical and verifiable evidence. You can verify it. It's not regarding the origins or the beginning of life, but really it's more to do with the end of life. And I highlighted it in the green color here, and it's right in the middle column because it speaks about physical death that is followed by physical resurrection. Why do I say there may be some evidence for this? So I would say, in terms of faith or religion, why would I say there's some evidence for this? Okay, well, let's have a look. If you look at the spirit religions, like Buddha, wise man, but he's gone. He can't come and tell us what's it all about now and how what's going to happen to me when I'm gone. Einstein, who fits in the same column, he's gone. He's not here anymore to figure things out and tell me. If you go to the other extreme, materialism, you know, Marx, Lenin, all these chaps who believe that, you know, it's all about matter. But they're gone and dead, and they believe that they're gone forever. So they tell you already, once I'm gone, I'm not coming back to tell you anything else. You know, so that's it. I don't exist anymore. What about the middle column, where it's spirit and matter are intermingled? This is a very interesting column, and you can classify this column as Abrahamic religions, because there are three religions that come and fit into this column, and they all stem from one man called Abraham. Yeah? So, that would be the Jewish religion first, Judaism, then Christianity, and then Islam. So Judaism, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, they all fit in this middle column. And they, in principle, they believe the similar things about the beginning and the end. Physical death, followed by physical resurrection. So if you look at the Judaism, and there are a couple of clever rabbis who lived in this world throughout history, a couple of them really, really clever, and followed by many Jews, but they're gone. And they're not here to, they can't help us. Muhammad, well, he's gone, and looking at Quran and all that stuff, it's difficult to ascertain any kind of evidence. It's not like, it's very scarce, any kind of evidence. So he's gone. But there is one person, in fact, there's only one person who gave some evidence regarding what happens after we die. Only one person. And his claims are supported by the most attested or documented ancient historical document. And it's based on the accounts given by eyewitnesses and written by eyewitnesses. So, if you read the beginning of the Gospel of Luke. Now, a lot of people who study theology or Bible or religion nowadays, they're atheists, you know. They don't believe in God, they study it. And, you know, some high people in some churches, they don't believe in God really, but they still study this. And everybody agrees that Luke was a historian. They all agree. Presents everything in a detailed historical account, and they read it as a history. You know, all the kings mentioned, the regions, the territories, the years, the names, it can all be verified. So say it's a historical document. So basically he was like what you would consider nowadays a scientist. He writes from that perspective. So this is what he says. The Gospel of Luke, the beginning. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Well, so he's talking about the eyewitnesses here. He's not talking about, oh, I believe this, or I think this is true. No, so I'm just talking about the eyewitnesses. I'm looking at the evidence, you know, as if it needs to be presented in the court of law. I'm just looking for the eyewitnesses. I'm not interested in, you know, telltales of what I think or what I believe. So eyewitnesses. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated, now this is more like, you know, CSI, crime scene investigation, than maybe a religious experience or activity. It's very scientific. Since I have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. Does he say to this Theophilus, so that you may believe what I believe? He doesn't use the word faith here. What does he use? The word certainty. So he's talking about, this is the real thing. It's a historical event. This is not religion. I'm telling you, based on the account of eyewitnesses, I've investigated it. This is a real thing. Whether it's religious or not, that's irrelevant. He's using the word certainty rather than faith. Very strong word. So, if you look at the New Testament evidence now, it's really quite remarkable, considering how old these documents are. Really, really quite remarkable. And some of you may have seen this column before, or something similar. And this is a collection of some of the key ancient documents from about, you know, 2,500 years ago, that we still read today, and they're taken as, you know, classics. So for instance, if you look at the columns, it starts with who wrote it, when it was written, when the earliest copy is found, and then time between original and copy. So if it's been like 1,000 years before, between the original it was written, and the first copy was found 1,000 years later, how do you know if it's not been tampered with or changed? 1,000 years later, it's really hard to check or verify. Number of copies, and then accuracy of copies. When you compare them all and see the differences, is there any differences? You put in percentage, and that's what you get. So Plato, not many copies. I mean, his writings are the basis for the modern philosophy, really, throughout history. And it's still taught today at universities. So it's taken very seriously, but there are only 7 copies of Plato found, and yet he's been taught at universities. And he lived, you know, 5th, 4th century BC. The earliest copy that was found was from AD 900. So time between his writing and the first copy that was found is 1,200 years, which is really, really a long time. So you really have to have some kind of element of faith to believe there's been no changes in these documents from the first copy to what we found 1,200 years. It requires some amount of faith to take. Herodotus, he was a historian, similar number of copies say it. So he's a historian, so his writings are taken pretty much relatively seriously, most of what he says. Lived at a similar time, earliest copy similar time, more than 1,000 years difference. So Caesar, I think it's his Wars, the Wars that he wrote. About 10 copies similar again. He lived 1st century BC. Again, the first copy, earliest copy found at the same time, 1,000 years still. Everybody knows about Caesar, you know, believes that that's taken for granted. Aristotle, another philosopher, a bit more copies here because it was very popular in the Middle Ages, almost 50 copies. He lived 4th century BC. But again, time between when he wrote his books and between the first copy that was found is almost 1,500 years. Yet he's probably taken most seriously in terms of studying philosophy and science from those days. Now Homer, this is a similar one. You know, Odyssey and Iliad and all these Greek films that we watch, you know, Titans, Clash of the Titans, and similar stuff like that. That sort of stuff. Well, there are like 650 copies almost found. So that's quite serious. And the time elapsed between him writing and the first copy found is 500 years. That's much better now, almost 3 times as short as Aristotle. But still, 500 years is a long time. And people lived short in those days, not as long as we do now. So, you know, 5, 6, 7 generations maybe been and gone. How do you know it's what actually has been written originally? How do you know that? It's difficult to verify. When you come to the accuracy of copies, that actually says that it's probably true, because all the copies found all over the world, wherever they are, they're 95% identical. So that suggests it's probably the real deal. It's very much high percentage. And then you come to the New Testament. And this is really fascinating. Just think about it. All these things come from the same Greco-Roman world. You know, in the Roman world. And suddenly, if you look at the New Testament, the number of copies jumps to almost 6,000. It was written in the 1st century AD, and earliest copy. Now this is conservative. There may be even earlier, but I just stick with the conservative. AD 125, a fragment of the Gospel of John. Now, some people there say even earlier, but let's just stick with the conservative. AD 125. Now John, most people agree he lived longer than any other apostle, and he probably was alive at the end of the first century. So maybe 30, maybe 40 years after John died, the copy of John's Gospel was found. What does that mean? 30 years later, lots of people who knew John, talked to him, they're still alive when this copy was found. So they can actually say, oh yeah, that John said that, yeah. Or, no, he didn't say that. So this is actually the first document you can actually verify, because there's still eyewitnesses there when the document was, earliest document was found. If you look at the accuracy of the copies, this is incredible, really, because modern science, if you want to prove a theory as you know, axiom or something true, has to be really, really high, 99.9 something, really, has to be really, really high percentage. So this comes pretty close to the modern science, you know, verifying theories, 99.5%. Keep in mind that lots of copies are found in Africa, some in the Middle East, some in the West. And there are no internet, there are no trains, there are no bikes in those days. People did not interact like we do today. So they did not communicate with each other. So when they copied manuscripts, you think if there's any changes, they could not compare with each other. And yet you find that accuracy is 99.5%. It's really incredible, almost miraculous, if you compare it to everything else. Really, really incredible accuracy. So this is why I would say Luke said what he says. I really investigated. There's lots of stuff here. I'm putting together a document. A certainty of a historical event that took place. He's talking about the resurrection of Jesus, the man who died and he came back to life again. Now, parts of the New Testament have been preserved in more manuscripts than any other ancient work, actually coming to about 6,000 Greek manuscripts. That's the basis, you know, that's the closest to the original. But then you have also Latin manuscripts, 10,000. And another 10,000 manuscripts from Syriac, Slavic, Gothic, Ethiopic, Coptic, Armenian, all kinds. So, you know, almost 30,000. It's a lot. It's a lot compared to, you know, from 2,000 years ago, all that stuff. Incredible, really, how that was preserved for us. So is this really just a matter of faith? It's a bit more serious than that. So, we have an account, the only one account of somebody, of one man, that Luke and some other people, a historian, we could call him a scientist, claimed that this man, Jesus Christ of Nazareth, he was condemned in the court of law by the Romans, by the Jewish authorities, and he was crucified and he died, and he came back to life, not as a spirit, but in his body. Just rose from the grave, and he came out. And this is what Paul says, talking about eyewitnesses again, the Apostle Paul. Now, brothers, I want to remind you of the gospel I preached to you, which you received, and on which you have taken your stand. By this gospel, you are saved. If you hold firmly to the word I preached to you, otherwise you have believed in vain. And elsewhere, Paul says, if Christ did not come back from the dead, everything you believe is in vain. It's pointless. So if it's not a real historical event, forget about your religion, it's pointless. For what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins, according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day, according to the scriptures, and then he appeared to Peter, and then to the 12. Not bad, but then what follows is quite incredible. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep or died. So he's saying there is more than 500 eyewitnesses Christ coming back to life after he died. Whether you want to take this as a matter of faith or a matter of evidence, it's up to you. But Luke speaks about certainty, and Paul speaks about eyewitnesses. And really, when you look at religion and science as it is presented, sometimes what you see on TV, what's promoted, propaganda, they put down religion, especially Christianity. The science people say they're great friends with Buddhism and Hinduism. They love it because there's no personal God there who will judge. They always talk about great things, but Christianity, it's always put down as it's like some kind of, you know, it's just religion, just faith. It's not true, is it? This is how it is presented. Whereas science is exalted as highly true and factual, whereas look at the origins, it's not true. We're all in the same boat, no matter how clever we are or not. We're all in the same boat. We all have to make certain choices based on limited evidence and certain amount of faith. We all have to faith, whether you're a scientist or not, whether you're religious people or not. And this is really the conclusion of the matter. And there is only one man in history called Jesus Christ who has given us some kind of evidence as to our religious experience and a promise for the future, the resurrection of the body, where we will remain alive as persons, feeling the same, thinking the same, having the memories we have, our personality to be preserved forever in a physical body. This is the promise that we are asked to believe, but not blindly, because it's based on the accounts of the eyewitnesses and historical evidence. So it is up to us to make the choice how we relate to this person. Thank you for listening. God bless you.